This is America Weekend, a new kind of radio because life doesn't stop on the weekends. Hello, I am Paul Harris. Kenneth Couquier is the data editor of The Economist. The data is the important word in that because he is an expert on data and co-author of a new book called Big Data, a revolution that will transform how we live, work, and think. And welcome to America Weekend, Kenneth.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. In this book, you say that we've always used information to make decisions, but there's a radical change taking place in the amount of data we're giving up and the amount of data being gathered about us. We've seen a lot of talk about this in the last couple of weeks in the NSA spying story. How much of a giant industry has big data become even outside of the government?
Well, it's absolutely vast, of course. We can just think of how we did things maybe 10 or 15, 20 years ago and how we do it today, and there's really no comparison. So in the past, we went to a library card catalog. No one could see what we were looking for, and then we went into the stacks of the library. Now we go to Google and find everything else. Now, the good news is we get things in 0.6 seconds, much more information than before. The bad news for some people is that that information is captured and can be reused. Some of the reuse is for advertising, but other reuse is really interesting, and I want to focus on the really positive uses. For example, Google can look at old search queries that are anonymized, no personal information there, but we only know what the person looked for, and can identify where the outbreak of a flu is simply by old search queries alone. And that's really interesting, and it's very useful information for people like public health authorities who might want to know when a pandemic is underway, how to stop it.
So they've actually done this? They've gone in and said, okay, who was typing in, for instance, H1N1 or SARS or something like that? And they can see geographically, based on who typed that into the Google search bar, where there might be problems with this?
The answer is yes, but it's even better than that. You don't have to know in advance what they searched for, because they might have searched for sneezing and they might have searched for cough medicine. You don't have to make the presumption that you're smarter than everyone else in the world and can identify what it is. Google didn't make that presumption. They ran through 50 million search terms over a 5-year period. They crunched almost 500 million mathematical models, and they found the very terms themselves through this, what correlated best with where the outbreak of the flu actually was, so they could predict it almost in real time.
Now, that's fascinating to me, the almost in real time part. Now, did Google take out, did Google take some of its people and say, okay, go work on this, see if we can figure out where the flu is going to be a problem? Or did the CDC go to Google and say, help us with this? How did that kind of research into their own data come about?
Great question. So you know what it was? It's a combination of Google employees and Google corporate. Google employees get the benefit of taking what's called 20% time. They basically take roughly a couple hours a day, maybe an hour a day, that they can do their own thing. And when you have very highly educated, highly creative people, they respond to that very well. So on their free time, they started thinking about what to do. Now, when Google found out about it, they realized this is a very good thing, and they encouraged them to do this because it's a great showing point of how Google can actually reuse information importantly. And a couple years ago, this research was published in Nature, which is one of the most prestigious scientific journals in the world. So it showed that this was peer-reviewed, and it was vetted, and it was very substantial research. The CDC and other public health authorities are a little bit behind the times. They rely on reported data from hospitals and from doctors, so they didn't actually think that this would be the way that they could get information that could be useful. But I guarantee you that in the future, places like the CDC, places like the Fed, other central banks will be licensing Google data, and maybe Twitter and Facebook's as well, so that they can have a lens into the economy in real time rather than always have a reporting lag.
All right, so that's a great use by a big company, Google, and some government agencies and health providers into figuring out a solution to a problem, or at least being able to spot a problem before it becomes, as you say, a pandemic. But what about on the smaller scale? You have a story in the book about paint and how the color of the paint of a used car tells you about the condition of that car. Would you share that with my audience?
Absolutely. So a person, a businessman who buys used cars at a large used car auction to put into used car lots, wanted to know what is the best predictor that if I'm going to buy these cars that they are not going to have a breakdown, because not only does the customer have this worry, but you can imagine companies that own used car lots that can buy many cars, you know, say 250,000 cars on the market at once, want to know this information too because they don't want to be stuck with a lemon. So when we looked through all of the data of scientists, I should say, from Coggle, a company that actually runs these sort of competitions, when the data scientists looked through all of the data and looked at all the different variables, what struck out at them was that cars that were painted orange were far less likely to have problems after they were purchased than cars painted any other color. So if it was blue or if it was gray or it was black, there was roughly a certain level of problems with it, and it was roughly the same, but it was much, much less likely to have any problems if it was orange. Now, the key thing is this. We don't know why that's the case. Is it because it's such a bright color that it was never in an accident so that it's running better? Is it because it's such a custom color that it was made in a more tailorized, custom way? We don't know the answer. All we know is the correlation. But that's good enough, because if we wanted to buy a car, we could save money with some confidence that it's probably not going to have a breakdown.
All right. Now, all of this sounds like data is good, data gathering is good, using all this economic information and numeric information and crunching those numbers is a great thing. But there's also a dark side to this, isn't there?
There is, and it's a very serious one, and we need to, as a society, think about it and come to terms with it and have a public debate and open discussion. The first one is obviously privacy. Privacy has been a big concern in a small data universe. It's going to be a bigger concern in big data. That's obvious. But the second one, which is new, is propensity, and that's the idea that algorithms will be making predictions about what we are likely to do, and we may be penalized prior to us actually having committed the infraction. So you can imagine that a big data algorithm says that you are going to have to pay this sort of loan rate, or that you're going to be denied insurance because you have this propensity for this sort of disease. And you can say, well, wait a minute, I've not had a problem. It sounds like Minority Report, and it is. So already in many communities in America, there are something called predictive policing, in which algorithms and big data is used to determine where do the police forces send their cops on the beat. And so as the big data society moves forward, we're going to need to build in the same sort of accountability and transparency that we've come to expect in the small data universe in the big data world as well.
Now, we know that math is always math. 2 + 2 is always 4. It's never 3. It's never 5. But when you add people into the equation, it's how they interpret the data that can become a problem. You talk about that policing instance. Somebody looks at that and says, okay, well, we have to go into these neighborhoods, and now all of a sudden arrests are up in certain neighborhoods, and now that those numbers look like they say, oh, there's more bad people in that neighborhood, when in fact it may just be that there's a heavier police presence there. What about the subjectivity of the people using the data?
You know, that's the most important point. We need to be very wise as a society that as we put more faith in data and trust data, that we do it in a responsible way. And you've identified that, in fact, just by dint of putting more cops in a certain area, we will find more crime because there's more sets of eyes looking for it. We know in American history the problems of an over-reliance on data. The Vietnam War was fought for multiple reasons, but the body count became the data point that defined an era. It was used to assess progress when the situation on the ground was far more complex, and we learned that tragically. So I think we need to be humbled before big data, and we need to use this tool with humanity and humility.
And how worried should we be about, going back to the first thing I brought up here, the government spying on us through all of this information and all this data that we are unwittingly providing the world every single day?
You know, I think we should be, I believe, we're a country that believes in vigilance and governance and rule of law. So we also understand that we have global responsibilities to interact with the world in a responsible way. And we also know that there are people who want to harm us, so we need to balance the proper use of a surveillance function by the government. And I think we can all sign up for that. It's reasonable. At the same time, with the protections that it's not being used in a terrible ends, or that it could not be used in terrible ends. Because from what we know now, the NSA spying activity seems to be tolerable because it's used, you know, under the rule of law. The problem that Snowden identified is that the technical capability exists that you can just simply get rid of the law, and then you have, as he called it, turnkey tyranny. Now, I am sensitive to both issues, so what I think we really need to do is have that open debate that President Obama and others have called for, and really responsibly understand that we need to boost the law that we apply onto these new technologies, because these technologies of surveillance have far exceeded the law. It's almost as if we have the rules for sword fighting in the age of the machine gun. And that doesn't look like the right balance anymore for American citizens. So we still need surveillance, but we also still need to improve the law with which that surveillance happens.
Absolutely. The law has to catch up. And for us to have the debate, we first have to know what's being done in our name, because none of us is reading that Apple agreement to allow them to use our data. Kenneth Kukier, the author of Big Data. Great guest. Thanks for joining me today on America Weekend. America Weekend.